leaves the chief financial officer $1.6 million left to spend. They then greenlight Project C, which requires a $500,000 investment, leaving $1.1 million to invest. They should then approve Project B, which will use up the remaining $1.1 million of available investment capital. Projects A and D, while both positive net present value projects, would make sense to do if there were another $1.4 million of capital available. Otherwise, these get shelved and perhaps considered at some future point in time. The final alternative to net present value that I would like to introduce in this lecture is something known as the equity multiple. It is very commonly used in private equity and venture capital investments. You may have heard of companies like Blackstone, the Carlyle Group, or Kohlberg, Kravis, and Roberts, firms that offer private investment funds, or venture capital firms like Kleiner Perkins or Sequoia Capital. These firms would likely use both the internal rate of return and equity multiples to communicate their investment performance. The equity multiple is actually fairly easy to calculate, and that is partly what makes it attractive. You simply take the cumulative amount of returns that you have been paid on an investment over time, divided by the amount of the investment actually made. Again, you simply take the cumulative distributed returns over time divided by the capital invested. So assume that you invest $50,000 in a venture capital fund, and over the 5-year life of the fund, you receive a total of $125,000 in distributions. Thus, the equity multiple is simply 2.5, the $125,000 in distributions divided by the $50,000 invested. Obviously, the time value of money is ignored under this approach, which differentiates the equity multiple from other valuation methods, such as the internal rate of return or net present value. But it is simple. And for certain types of investments that are relatively short in duration, like private equity or venture funds, it can be a reasonable way of comparing different funds or fund sponsors. However, without some sense of the time horizon over which the investment was owned, as well as the related risks, it is not a robust return measure. In my opinion, both IRR and NPV are superior. During the last two lectures, we have introduced several methods employed to evaluate investment projects: the payback method, net present value, internal rate of return, and now equity multiples. From a theoretical standpoint, net present value is certainly the most robust, and people with training in finance would recommend its use. However, what one finds empirically out in the real world is that different organizations and investors use different methods. And my experience is that net present value is not as widely used as the internal rate of return or equity multiples, each of which has significant shortcomings. The fact that they are easier to communicate and understand trumps their academic and theoretical shortcomings. So what should an investor do? My recommendation is simple. While internal rates of return or equity multiples may be intuitively appealing when you're considering an investment, they are fundamentally flawed, and you really should use a more analytical approach. You should compute net present values on the projected cash flows you anticipate and what you believe is the appropriate discount rate for the investment. That is the rate of return that you think should appropriately compensate you for the risk that you are taking on. Then, as we discussed in our last lecture, you should always consider sensitivity analysis. What if scenarios? Perhaps an estimated base case, best case, and worst case for any investment you are considering. Doing this will make you a much better and more thoughtful investor. Until next time, when we will discuss discount rates in greater detail and give greater color and context to the interest rates we should use in applying our finance models. Until then, thank you very much.
This lecture is titled, Weighing the Costs of Debt and Equity.
In February of 2014, the electric car manufacturer Tesla Motors sold approximately $2 billion of bonds in order to help finance a large battery manufacturing facility and support the development of future generations of electric cars. About half of the bonds were, quote, convertible senior notes due in 2019, end quote. And the other half were, quote, convertible senior notes due in 2021, end quote. Each note paid very modest interest of 0.25% and 1.25% per year, respectively. That is, the notes paid some interest, just like normal bonds, but they had another important feature that allowed the note holders to potentially convert their notes into shares of Tesla common stock. Clearly, with such a low interest rate, investors placed a lot of value in the potential conversion option attached to the bonds. Meanwhile, about a year before Tesla issued its bonds, in the spring of 2013, Apple completed the largest corporate bond issuance in history, selling $17 billion of standard bonds, that is, bonds with no conversion feature. Unlike Tesla's relatively short-term bonds, Apple sold bonds with maturities going out as far as 30 years, paying rates just slightly in excess of the rates on U.S. Treasury securities at the time. Why did Tesla issue convertible bonds with reasonably short durations, while Apple sold standard bonds that pay just cash interest? Why didn't Tesla just issue shares of stock as opposed to the convertibles, which combine features of both a note and common stock? What are the trade-offs between issuing one type of security, debt or equity, versus another? What are the potential implications of such a decision? Answering these important questions is the goal of this lecture. In order to fund operations and necessary capital expenditures, firms turn to any number of potential sources, including borrowing money from a bank or other financial institution, issuing notes or bonds to investors, and selling shares of stock in the firm. Other firms like Tesla issue convertible bonds, a hybrid security that is a combination of a bond that pays interest, along with a so-called equity kicker, a potential or contingent interest in the issuer's stock. Many firms use a combination of all of these approaches to raise necessary funds. In 1958, two academic researchers, Merton Miller and Franco Modigliani, published a seminal paper entitled, quote, "The Cost of Capital, Corporation Finance, and the Theory of Investment," end quote. The premise of their work was relatively simple, that the value of any firm is independent of how it finances its business. That is, whether a firm finances its business entirely with debt, entirely with equity, or some combination of the two is irrelevant, in that the value of that firm will not change. In the most basic terms, their theory concludes that the size of any pizza, here the value of a company, does not change depending on how you slice that pizza up. The amount allocated to any individual piece of pizza may change, but the sum total remains the same. In effect, the message from Miller and Modigliani would be, don't try to make your shareholders wealthier by adjusting debt levels. Instead, the company's best capital structure is one that supports the operations and investments of the business. Although their theorem sounds so simple, it is considered a cornerstone of corporate finance and has spawned significant additional research, much of which has tried to undercut some of the basic assumptions that Miller and Modigliani made to support their thesis. The reality is that there are several accounting, finance, and corporate governance differences between debt and equity, and therefore a decision to issue one or the other can impact the value of a firm, contradicting the Miller-Modigliani theorem. That is, by changing the capital structure of a firm, its value may, in fact, increase or decrease depending on the circumstances. Why? Well, before we delve too deeply into answering this question, let's first discuss some critical trade-offs and differences between debt and equity. The first concept is fundamental to all of finance and actually served as the impetus for Miller and Modigliani's research. The cost of debt is cheaper than the cost of equity. Again, the cost of debt to any investor is cheaper or less expensive than the cost of equity. For example, investors in a company's bonds expect a lower return than investors who might purchase stock in that same company, all else equal. Why? Well, let's think about what investors expect when they buy either a company's bonds or its stock. Generally speaking, when an investor purchases a company's debt, what are the investor's expectations? Well, a typical bond or debt investor anticipates receiving periodic payments of interest and a repayment of the bond's principal when the bond matures. For example, anyone who purchased one of the 10-year bonds that Apple issued in 2013 expects to receive 2.415% in interest each year, in addition to the principal amount of the bonds when they mature in 2023. There is no additional upside, and nobody who purchases such bonds expects to get rich. The investor's return has a ceiling. For any investor owning the bonds until maturity, the most they can make each year is 2.415% before taxes, ignoring any impact of inflation. On the other hand, if an investor purchases a company's common stock, what are his or her expectations? This may depend on the particular company at issue, but one thing is certain. There is going to be much more variability in the ultimate outcome. And because of this additional risk, investors expect to be appropriately compensated. For example, debt generally requires issuers to make periodic payments of interest. And if they fail to make an interest payment, what happens? The bondholders can sue the issuer, potentially forcing it into bankruptcy. Exactly what happened to General Motors and the city of Detroit, for example. On the other hand, companies are not required to pay dividends on their stock. They are discretionary. In addition, because a share of common stock represents an actual ownership interest in the company, there is no ceiling on the return that an investor might earn. If Apple stock goes up 20% this year and continues to pay dividends, owners of the common stock will have done much better than the owners of the company's bonds. Of course, the flip side is also true. If Apple stock declines by 20% this year, shareholders would have fared worse than bondholders. The stocks are obviously more risky than bonds, and therefore investors expect a higher return for owning them. Moreover, in the event of the insolvency of a firm, debt has preference over equity in bankruptcy proceedings. Think about what happens, for example, in a house foreclosure. The lender or mortgage holder takes possession of the house, wiping out the homeowner's interest, their equity, in the house. I realize this example is a painful memory for many of us living in the wake of the Great Recession, but it highlights an important concept in finance, that debt has preference over equity. The same is true with corporate bankruptcies. Sadly, stockholders usually lose their entire investments in such events. While bondholders also can and do get hurt in bankruptcies, their losses can be buffered by the fact that they receive preferential treatment. Thus, as a trade-off, the bondholders receive lower expected returns than stock or equity holders, simply because they are assuming less risk. A second significant difference has to do with Uncle Sam. Interest payments are tax deductible, while dividends paid to shareholders are not. This is an extremely important issue and truly fundamental to the trade-offs between debt and equity, and one that was mistakenly ignored in Miller and Modigliani's original paper. Our government subsidizes the issuance of debt by providing firms with a tax deduction for interest expense. Frankly, it is analogous to how the government encourages home ownership by allowing homeowners to deduct mortgage interest. This economic carrot can be quite significant and encourages increased borrowing and leverage. For example, if we consider a firm with a 30% combined state and federal tax rate that issues 6% bonds, the company can deduct 30% of the total amount it pays on those bonds. So the after-tax cost of the bonds is actually 70% of the 6% rate, or 4.2%. This is not an insignificant difference. Thus, at the margin, if a firm is deciding whether to issue debt or stock, the value of the firm can be impacted by the value of the tax shield derived from the interest deductions over time. Think of it as a wealth transfer between Uncle Sam and shareholders. Modigliani and Miller conceded the point in a paper they published in 1963 and acknowledged that some value can be created by issuing debt as opposed to equity. Just how much remains a vigorous debate, since all agree that an organization's cash flows, its strategy, and its products and services are far more influential in terms of value than capital structure, but it is an important point. So if debt is cheaper than equity and is tax-favored, why don't firms just issue copious amounts of debt instead of stock, thereby increasing the value of the firm? Well, one, unlike equity, debt has a maturity date and must be repaid. As we discussed, debt typically requires periodic payments of interest, unlike dividends, which are issued at the discretion of the company's board of directors. Thus, as companies continue to pile on debt, the risks related to the firm's potential insolvency outweigh the benefits of that additional debt. Another fundamental difference between debt and equity has to do with corporate governance and control. Shareholders are able to elect a company's directors and to approve certain matters regarding executive compensation, mergers and acquisitions, and so forth. Granted, most retail shareholders do not usually hold enough shares to sway elections, but we still get to vote, while bondholders typically do not. Usually this would not have an impact on valuation, but it might if, say, a corporation is closely held, with a significant number of voting shares held by one or a few individuals. Companies like Berkshire Hathaway or Google come to mind, where two different classes of shares are out there, one with significantly greater voting rights than the other. For example, Google Class B shares, principally owned by the company's founders, have 10 votes for each share, while Class A shares, owned by the investing public, retain only one vote per share. Therefore, there is no way that an outside investor or another company could ever get control of or take Google over without the founders' consent. This would have some negative impact on the company's value. Okay, now that we have discussed some fundamental differences between debt and equity, let's talk a little more formally about the relative costs of each and the impact the costs have on financial decisions and valuation. As we said, debt generally requires periodic, tax-deductible interest payments. We therefore say that the cost of debt, or KD for short, is the interest rate on the debt times 1 minus the tax rate. We walked through an example earlier when we said that a firm with 6% debt and a 30% tax bracket incurred an after-tax cost of debt of 4.2%. 4.2% is 6% times 1 minus 30%. The cost of equity is trickier, since the cost of such equity is equal to the expected return that an equity investor anticipates from owning that stock. And this expected return is in turn derived from asset pricing models, like the capital asset pricing model we introduced earlier in this course. You will recall that in CAPM, the expected return of an asset, in this case an equity investment in stock, is equal to the risk-free rate plus a company's beta times the amount that the overall market is expected to earn above the risk-free rate. As we discussed, most experts peg this equity risk premium at 5 or 6%. Because we are now talking about the cost of equity, we will use KE instead of RA. Again, KE, the cost of equity, equals the risk-free rate plus beta times the equity risk premium. Assume, for example, that the 10-year treasury yield is 2.6%, A company's beta is 1.5, and the equity risk premium is 5%. In this scenario, the company's cost of equity is equal to 2.6% plus 1.5 times the 5%. That's 2.6% plus 7.5%. Add them together, and you get a KE, a cost of equity, of 10.1%. Now that we can compute both the cost of debt and the cost of equity, let's step back and consider how most capital projects or investments are typically made. They normally involve a combination of debt and equity. For example, when we purchase a piece of real estate, what do we generally do? We usually take out a mortgage for a large part of the purchase price, while the remainder comes out of our pockets, perhaps from cash reserves. Even when investing in stocks, you can borrow some of the money required, something called a margin loan. Thus, borrowing money is often part of an investment decision, both in business and in our personal lives. Well, to the extent that we are using both debt and equity to make investments, and each source has its own cost after taxes, we can compute something called the weighted average cost of capital for any investment we might make. The weighted average cost of capital, sometimes known as WACC, is a very important concept in finance and valuation. To understand why, let's walk through a simple example. Assume you are planning to purchase a new home for $500,000, putting $100,000 down and borrowing the remainder, or $400,000. Let's assume the $400,000 mortgage has an interest rate of 4% before taxes, and in order to fund the $100,000 down payment, you sold some stocks, which you estimate would have earned 10% after taxes each year if you hadn't sold them. The last variable we need to think about is the relevant tax rate. So let's assume that your combined state and federal tax rate is 25%. What is your weighted average cost of capital for this real estate investment? Well, you took out a 4% loan for 80% of the home's purchase price. But remember that the 4% interest is tax deductible. So the after-tax cost of debt is actually 4% times 1 minus 25%, or 75% of the 4%, which gives you a cost of debt equal to 3%. Wow, now we really see how interest rates can spur home demand, since the after-tax cost of mortgages can be really, really low. Meanwhile, the cost of equity is just the opportunity cost related to having money tied up in the house as opposed to the stock market. And remember, you estimated that to be 10% after taxes. Now, stepping back, it is clear that the cost of the mortgage debt is cheaper than the cost of the down payment or the equity. What if you had used all equity to buy the house, selling $500,000 of stock to make the purchase? Ignoring any capital gains that might have had to be paid on the sale of the stock, the after-tax cost of this transaction would be 10%. Thus, the relevant cost of equity would be 10%. If we are strictly looking at the house as an investment and ignoring the psychic or personal benefits we derive from owning a house, if the house does not increase in value by that same 10% rate, it would have a negative net present value. This is merely looking at the house dispassionately as an investment, which is perhaps something people should do more often. On the other hand, what if we could borrow 100% of the purchase price of the house, which is something that did happen in the last housing bubble? In this case, assuming we could borrow the entire purchase price at 4% before taxes, the relevant cost of capital is just 3%. Granted, banks might have charged a higher rate for borrowing the entire purchase price, but it would still be far less costly than using equity. However, as we've mentioned, one would normally purchase a house using both debt and equity. Therefore, we need to compute the weighted average cost of capital for funds used in such transactions. In the case of our $500,000 home purchase, the WACC, the weighted average cost of capital, would simply be 80% times 3% for the debt component, plus 20% times 10% for the equity component. That's 2.4% plus 2%, which gives us a WACC of 4.4%. The weighted average cost of capital is extremely important for three reasons. First, because it highlights the different costs of debt and equity, taking taxes into account. Second, it reflects the empirical reality as to how capital investments are generally undertaken, employing a mix of both debt and equity. And third, and perhaps most importantly, because it provides the appropriate discount rate we should use in computing net present values to evaluate investment opportunities. That is, thinking back to our earlier lecture on net present value, for any investment to create value, it must earn more than the weighted average cost of the capital used to make the investment. So in our house purchase example, where we computed a weighted average cost of capital of 4.4%, if the house does not appreciate that much on average each year, it will not be a value-creating investment. Now, the weighted average cost of capital can be expressed in a formula, which is definitely an item you should have in your toolkit. Basically, you compute it by taking the estimated cost of each source of capital, KD and KE, respectively, as we have defined them, times the relative percentages of each source of capital used to fund the project. The only other twist is to remember that the cost of debt, our KD, is tax deductible, so we need to multiply it by 1 minus the tax rate. Again, the WACC formula is equal to the cost of equity times its relative amount in the capital structure for the investment, plus the cost of debt after taxes, again, times its percentage used in the total amount of capital to make the investment. We can actually use this weighted average cost of capital formula to estimate the cost of capital for an entire company, which would be a very important data point for a company's chief financial officer in considering whether to approve capital projects or not. For example, let's take a look at IBM. Using publicly available data, estimate the company's weighted average cost of capital as of June 2014, using the formula we just introduced. One, the company has debt outstanding of about $46.5 billion, the sum of its long-term and short-term debt. Two, based on its most recent debt offering, IBM's pre-tax cost of debt is 3.625%. Three, the company's actual tax rate is 20%. Four, IBM's stock market capitalization is about $190 billion. That is computed by simply taking the company's stock price on the New York Stock Exchange, multiplied by the number of shares of common stock the company has outstanding. Fifth, according to Yahoo Finance, IBM's beta is 0.7. You will recall that a beta of 0.7 means that on average, if the stock market moves up or down by X, IBM stock goes up or down by 0.7 times that amount. The last two pieces of information we need are the risk-free rate, which is the yield on the 10-year treasury bonds, and the overall equity risk premium, which is the amount we expect the stock market to outperform risk-free investments. Let's assume a risk-free rate of 2.5% and an equity risk premium of 5%. Taking all this information, we can compute IBM's overall weighted average cost of capital. First, let's compute the company's after-tax cost of debt. It is equal to the cost of their debt times 1 minus the tax rate, or 3.625% times 1 minus 20%, or 2.9%. That's the easiest part. To compute the estimated cost of equity, we are going to reach into our finance toolbox and retrieve the capital asset pricing model, or CAPM. Remember that we start with the risk-free rate, here 2.5%, and add to it the beta-weighted equity risk premium, here equal to 0.7, the company's beta, times 5%, the equity risk premium, which equals 3.5%. Thus, the cost of equity for IBM is estimated to be 2.5% plus 3.5%, or 6%. Now, this is very low by historical standards, to be sure, but with interest rates and IBM's stock volatility so low, this is the result we get. Now that we have estimated the cost of both the debt and the equity, let's determine the relative values of each that IBM has in its current capital structure. First, let's add the company's debt, $46.5 billion, to the value of the company's common stock, $190 billion. That gives us a total of $236.5 billion. If we divide $190 billion by $236.5 billion, we see that equity represents 80.3% of IBM's capital structure. Therefore, debt represents 19.7% of IBM's capital structure. At this point, we can finally compute IBM's weighted average cost of capital by taking 80.3% times 6%, the cost of equity we computed, plus 19.7% times 2.9%, the after-tax cost of debt. The result is about 4.8%. Therefore, 4.8% would be the appropriate discount rate that IBM's chief financial officer might use today if it were funding a capital project using both 10-year bonds and some equity in about 80-20 proportions. Okay, now that we have a grasp on the weighted average cost of capital, let's return to the example I gave at the start of the lecture. You'll recall that I described a convertible debt offering by Tesla, which paid some very modest interest like a regular bond, but which was also convertible into shares of the company's common stock. This option gives bondholders significant potential upside if Tesla's common stock continues to appreciate over time. Convertible bonds are very common and what we call a hybrid security, since it has both debt and equity components. Why would Tesla issue such a security instead of issuing just plain debt or plain equity? Well, in part, it's because these securities really do represent a middle ground for both investors and issuers, perhaps the best of both worlds. And as a result, they can be attractive to investors. On the other hand, Tesla is a young company with audacious growth plans, and it has, therefore, a significant appetite for cash. It does not want to pay a very high rate of fixed interest, as would be required if it just issued bonds. As a young company, Tesla just can't borrow at the rates that IBM or Apple can. Secondly, Tesla is still not profitable and has therefore not begun to pay taxes. In fact, because it has various tax credits and loss carryforwards, the company is not likely to pay taxes for several years. As a result, Tesla would not get much, if any, value out of the tax deductibility of interest payments, at least for the time being, unlike Apple or IBM. As a result, Tesla is not so keen on just issuing debt. So why not just issue stock? Well, as we've discussed at length, the cost of equity is greater than debt, even ignoring the tax deduction. And for a young, risky company like Tesla, with a fairly volatile stock, its beta is nearly 1.4, more than double IBM's, Tesla's equity is far more expensive. Investors, recognizing the inherent riskiness of the company, expect to be appropriately compensated to own shares in the company. In addition, perhaps Elon Musk, the founder of the company and a large shareholder, may not want to dilute his ownership interest, at least not now. And finally, issuing just equity would reduce earnings per share if and when the company does report positive earnings. Thus, Convertibles offer a compromise, a sort of middle ground between debt and equity, and are commonly issued by smaller and riskier companies, especially technology companies. Oftentimes, these companies have expensive equity, are not paying taxes, and do not own a significant amount of tangible assets that could serve as collateral for debt. And therefore, convertible bonds are an attractive financing option. Well, this concludes our lecture on the trade-offs between debt and equity. In exploring these trade-offs, we've encountered some important concepts. First, we've seen that debt is not only cheaper than equity, but because of the tax deductibility of interest, issuing debt instead of equity can increase the value of firms, at least marginally, contrary to Miller and Modigliani's initial theory that capital structure cannot impact firm value. Second, because investors generally use both debt and equity to fund capital projects, we've learned that we should consider the weighted average cost of capital, or WACC, associated with any investment. The weighted average cost of capital can then serve as the appropriate discount rate for use in net present value calculations. And finally, we've shown how that convertible bonds or hybrid securities highlight the debt and equity trade-off and try to capture the best of both worlds. Until next time, when we will wrap up our introduction to accounting and finance with some final thoughts on valuation. Thank you very much.
This lecture is titled, How to Value a Company Stock.
Warren Buffett, chairman of Berkshire Hathaway and perhaps the most famous investor alive today, has said that, quote, price is what you pay, value is what you get, end quote. It is one of my favorite investment quotes because it speaks directly to the disparity that can exist between a company's stock price and the value of its underlying assets. It also addresses something we pointed out in an earlier lecture, that all investors, whether individuals picking stocks or corporate chief financial officers choosing between capital projects, should strive to identify and make value-creating investment decisions, where the prices paid for assets are less than or equal to what they might be worth. In finance terms, we have described a value-creating investment as one that has a positive net present value, where the benefits we receive from the investment over time exceed the amount we invest, all viewed in today's dollars. And what are the consequences of failing to consider whether the projected returns of an investment will exceed the underlying costs of capital? Well, in part, this is what causes asset bubbles, whether in tulips, dot-com stocks, or real estate. When investors and capital providers lose sight of fundamental finance principles, economic catastrophe can ensue. So today, in this final lecture on the essentials of accounting and finance, we're going to keep a close eye on the fundamentals. We're going to apply many of the tools we discussed in prior lectures, and we're going to learn how these tools can help us determine whether a particular stock might be under or overvalued. In other words, we're going to sharpen our ability to make value-creating investment decisions. Let's begin by reviewing several definitions that will be essential to this lecture, all of which should be in our toolkits. The first is EBITDA, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. You will recall that EBITDA is calculated by taking a company's income from operations as disclosed on the face of the income statement and adding back depreciation and amortization expense disclosed in the statement of cash flows. The second important term I would like to reintroduce is free cash flows. Free cash flows are the cash flows that a firm generates from its normal and recurring operations, less what it spends on capital expenditures, things like property, plant, and equipment. This is perhaps the most critical accounting metric for stock valuation, because the residual, or leftover cash that a firm generates after investing in its own business, is really what should support a company's stock price. That is, when you purchase a stock, you are really purchasing your share of a company's future free cash flows. One key attribute of free cash flows is that they should be unlevered, free of the impact of any debt that a company might have. The simple analogy we used was when we discussed the value of our homes. Home values are not affected by a buyer's choice either to pay all cash or to use a mortgage. We just look at the piece of real estate as a standalone asset. The buyer then divides the price that they pay, or the home's value, into the mortgage and the down payment. We must think along those same lines when looking at individual companies. The third definition we need to review is market capitalization, or the market value of equity, as it is more formally known. Market capitalization is the total stock market value for a particular company. It is simply calculated by multiplying the total number of shares of stock that a company has outstanding times its stock price. So, for example, if a company has 20 million shares outstanding and the company's stock is selling for $10 a share, the market value of the company's equity would be $200 million. The final definition I want to introduce is enterprise value. Enterprise value is the sum of the market value of a company's equity plus the market value of the company's net debt. Net debt is the amount of long-term debt a company has outstanding less the cash it owns. So, for example, if a company has $100 million of long-term debt outstanding and cash in the bank of $60 million, we say that the company's net debt is $40 million. And furthermore, if a company has a market capitalization of $200 million and net debt of $40 million, we say that its enterprise value is $240 million. Enterprise value reflects the total market value of a firm. Why is enterprise value so important? Well, you can think of enterprise value as the minimum amount that someone would have to pay to purchase an entire company. The acquirer would not only need to purchase all the outstanding shares of stock, but would also need to assume or take on the company's debt. However, they would also get to pocket the company's cash. Enterprise value, therefore, provides a far more complete picture of a firm's valuation than just its market capitalization. Using market capitalization alone would be like looking at just the equity a homeowner has and ignoring the amount of the mortgage to gauge the value of a home. Okay, now that we have introduced or reintroduced these critical definitions, let's talk about how we might value stocks. The general approach to valuing stocks is known as fundamental analysis, which entails an examination of quantitative and qualitative factors that might impact a company's value. These might include a review of the company's financial statements and ratios, its projected free cash flows, its management team, strategy, and competition, and even macroeconomic factors, all evaluated in the context of what a company is selling for in the marketplace. The goal of fundamental analysis is to determine whether a stock is undervalued and something we should buy, or overvalued and something we should likely avoid or even bet against. One starting point for performing fundamental analysis is to look at comparable companies, or the comps as they are often called. This is a common approach in valuing any sort of investment, where we simply compare one particular investment to one that is similar. For example, if evaluating whether Ford is undervalued, we might want to compare it to General Motors, or we might compare Apple to Samsung or Facebook to Twitter. It is very similar to how we value a single-family home by looking at what other homes in the neighborhood have recently sold for. In the context of valuation, one should always review a company's market capitalization and enterprise value, what the market is saying a company is worth, as compared to actual accounting data or accounting metrics, including those we've discussed in this course. For example, a very common valuation metric involves the price-earnings ratio, which is equal to the company's stock price divided by its diluted earnings per share. Two other common valuation metrics include the price to sales and price to EBITDA ratios. In these ratios, we take the market capitalization and divide it by the company's most recent annual total sales and EBITDA, respectively. Once we calculate any of these ratios for one company, they are typically compared to the ratios of other companies in the same industry. This allows us to make observations about relative valuation. Let's walk through a quick example using a company we have referred to quite often in these lectures, Apple. As of mid-2014, Apple had about 6 billion shares outstanding and a stock price of about $100 a share. Its market capitalization was therefore about $600 billion, computed by multiplying the two. Meanwhile, Apple had debt outstanding of $29 billion and cash and liquid securities of nearly $165 billion. Again, its market capitalization was $600 billion, debt outstanding was $29 billion, and it had cash and marketable securities of $165 billion. The first question is, what is Apple's enterprise value? Remember that enterprise value is the sum of the company's market capitalization and the market value of its net debt. In this case, $600 billion plus $29 billion minus $165 billion, or $464 billion. Great. Let's now compute Apple's price-earnings ratio. To calculate the price-earnings ratio, we divide a company's stock price by its earnings per share. For the 12 months ended June 2014, Apple's diluted earnings per share were $5.96. So what would the company's price-earnings ratio be? Well, we just divide $100 by $5.96, and we get a price-earnings ratio of about 16.8. And how about the price-to-EBITDA ratio? Well, for this ratio, we take the company's entire market capitalization divided by its EBITDA. So here, we will use the $600 billion in total stock market value for Apple and divide it by the company's most recent 12 months of EBITDA. Remember that EBITDA is the sum of income from operations plus depreciation and amortization. Well, Apple's income from operations for the 12 months ended June 2014 was $51.3 billion, and its depreciation and amortization, $7.8 billion. Therefore, its EBITDA was about $59.1 billion, calculated by adding the two figures together. Therefore, Apple's price-to-EBITDA ratio was about 10.2, dividing $600 billion by $59.1 billion. Knowing how to compute all of these ratios should be in our toolkits. However, you can always get them from various websites like Yahoo or Google Finance. What do we do with these ratios once we have computed them? Well, we can compare a company's ratios to its competitors, to broad market indices like the S&P 500, and to historical figures. And collectively, these comparisons would enable us to make some judgments about whether Apple's stock appears cheap or expensive. We probably would not stop there in our analysis, but these ratios are important and commonly cited. For example, it just so happens that the price-earnings ratio for the S&P 500, as of the date I wrote this lecture, was over 19.5. So Apple was less expensive than the S&P 500. Does this mean that Apple is a good buy at these prices? If only we had that proverbial crystal ball. What we can say is that Apple does not look overpriced compared to the broader stock market. However, perhaps the most important fundamental analysis used to value stocks involves discounted cash flow models, which integrate many of the concepts we have discussed in this course. Free cash flows, the time value of money, discount rates, and the cost of a firm's capital. Most Wall Street analyst reports on individual stocks include not only comparisons of price earnings and other ratios, but discounted cash flow analyses. At the most basic level, any company should be worth the net present value of its expected future free cash flows. After all, when we buy a stock, what are we paying for? We are not paying for the past earnings or cash flows that the company has generated. We are purchasing our pro rata share in all of the future cash flows the company might generate. However, as we've discussed in this course, we know that future cash flows are worth less than the current ones, and that there is inherent uncertainty and risk in those future cash flows. So we need to think about how to appropriately discount them, put those projected future cash flows into their current equivalents. Therefore, discounted equity or stock valuation models involve several steps. The first step is to compute the company's free cash flows for the past few years by examining historical financial statements. We do this by focusing on the statement of cash flows, examining the operating cash flows the company has reported, the interest expense it has reported, and the capital expenditures it has made. The second step is the trickiest, since we are not buying the past free cash flows when we buy a company stock, but the future ones. Therefore, we must project the future free cash flows based on the historical analysis we just performed and our best bet as to what the future free cash flows might look like. Clearly, this involves an analysis about the company's products, the markets in which it sells them, macroeconomic forecasts, and some good old intuition. Obviously, the future is inherently uncertain, and I am not one who believes in psychics, especially after the Psychic Friends Network went bankrupt several years ago. But doing our best to project the future is the only possible way we can make intelligent investment decisions. In the long run, we would normally expect companies to grow at some steady rate once they hit a certain size or level of sales. Most analysts and economists consider a 3 to 5% a year growth rate to be a reasonable one once a company reaches a certain size. However, for some firms, especially in the technology space, we assume stronger growth rates for some period of time, followed by a more normal and modest growth rate. Of course, this completely depends on the specific company and industry. Okay, once we have made our predictions of the company's future free cash flows, we must discount them to present value. To do this, we should use the firm's weighted average cost of capital, which we discussed in our last lecture. At this point, we will have our best estimate as to the present value of the company's expected free cash flows, an estimate of its overall value. This is where we can start to make some important observations, as we can compare this result to the actual enterprise value of the firm, the value that the markets are placing on the company, and can make our initial investment conclusion, whether the company appears over or undervalued. So in summary, here are the critical steps to performing equity valuation. One, evaluate the company's historical operating and free cash flows. Two, project the company's future free cash flows. Three, estimate the company's weighted average cost of capital. Four, discount all those projected cash flows by the weighted average cost of capital. And finally, five, compare this result to the company's total enterprise value and make some initial observations and conclusions. If the present value of the future cash flows you have projected is greater than the company's enterprise value, your initial conclusion would be that the company's stock is undervalued, and vice versa. Admittedly, this sounds very complicated, but actually it is not as difficult as it seems, at least the mathematical analysis. In my view, the hardest part is trying to predict what the future cash flows for any firm might be. That is especially challenging for technology firms where new products are constantly being introduced and new technology and competitors routinely emerge. As a result, before reaching any final conclusions, we must step back and reflect on our analysis and consider the assumptions we have made. Perhaps our projected future cash flows are aggressive or overly conservative, so we can tinker a bit with our assumptions to see how our conclusions might change if we modify our assumptions and projected growth rates. In any case, because it is hard to discuss discounted cash flow analysis in the abstract, let's apply these steps to some real-world companies. Let's first consider Southern Company, an electric utility that serves a large part of the southeastern United States. As of 2014, its common stock was selling for about $45 a share, and it paid an annual dividend of $2.05 a share. Moreover, in the several years prior to 2014, Southern Company consistently increased the dividend by about 3 to 3.5% each year. Now, as a regulated utility company, Southern Company's future growth will likely be modest, in line with the overall growth in the economy, and much of its return to shareholders will likely come in the form of cash dividends, just as they have in the past. So what is Southern Company stock worth? Well, let's assume that next year's dividend will increase to about $2.10 a share. Let's further assume a weighted average cost of capital of 6%, and that future dividends will continue to increase by just 2% each year, less than the more recent 3% growth rates in the company's dividend. Given these assumptions, can we use a discount model to estimate a value for Southern Company? Well, Southern Company stock almost sounds like a growing perpetuity, an investment paying a dividend which is expected to increase each year. If you recall our lecture on the time value of money, there is one shortcut way to calculate the present value of a growing perpetuity, where you take the cash flow projected for next year and divide it by the difference between the discount rate and expected future growth rate of the perpetuity. In this case, therefore, we can estimate the value of Southern Company stock to be $2.10, next year's projected dividend, divided by 4%. The difference between Southern's estimated weighted average cost of capital of 6% less the 2% expected dividend growth rate. $2.10 divided by 4% is $52.50. This valuation approach is appropriately known as the dividend discount model. So is Southern Company a good buy? Well, if you believe that the company's dividends will grow by at least 2% each year, and the company's weighted average cost of capital is 6%, the answer is yes, because the stock is only selling for $45 a share, and it appears to be worth $52.50. The problem with the dividend discount model is that many firms pay modest dividends or no dividends at all, especially the faster-growing technology and social media firms. These include high-growth and highly valued companies like Tesla Motors, Netflix, Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Therefore, we need a more robust discount model, which will be based on the company's overall projected free cash flows, discounted to present value. Because this approach provides an overall enterprise value, the value of the entire firm, we will then need to back into what our model might tell us about the company's stock price. Obviously, valuing firms like Facebook or LinkedIn is far more challenging because they are younger, growing rapidly, and volatile. They are certainly not in any sort of steady state of operations or growth, and in some cases, they are generating little, if any, free cash flow. Their stock prices reflect great optimism about their future earnings and cash flows. For example, in 2013, Netflix reported cash flows from operations of $97.8 million, but spent $120.1 million on capital expenditures and DVDs, resulting in negative free cash flows. Similarly, Tesla reported approximately $258 million in operating cash flows in 2013, but spent $264 million in capital expenditures. Thus, here we have two well-known, well-respected, and by all measures well-managed companies who are still not free cash flow positive. Yet the market capitalizations for each of these companies exceeds $25 billion. There are two possible conclusions here. One is that the market is anticipating tremendous future free cash flows from both of these companies. And or two, these companies are significantly overvalued. Of course, both could be true, that these companies will generate very strong cash flows in the future, but less than what Wall Street is expecting. Let me lay out another example to highlight the challenges of valuing high-growth companies before we go a little deeper into valuation mathematics. Take Amazon.com, the online retailer and manufacturer of the Kindle e-reader. It is now also selling phones, streaming music and movies, and providing third-party logistics services. It has expanded significantly beyond its roots as an online bookseller. Amazon generated free cash flows of approximately $1.04 billion during the past 12 months. Meanwhile, it has a market capitalization of approximately $142 billion. That's a multiple of about 136 times. Apple, on the other hand, generated free cash flows of about $49 billion during this same time frame. But it has a market capitalization of only $600 billion, about 12 times free cash flows. Imagine that. If Apple sold for the same multiple of free cash flows as Amazon.com, its stock price would be far greater than it is today, and it's already the most valuable company in the world. I realize that this may not exactly be an apples-to-apples comparison, so to speak, but it does give you a sense as to the challenges of valuation and deconstructing what assumptions the stock market is making about both companies. Are Apple's future cash flows that much more uncertain or risky than Amazon's? Will Amazon's future growth in free cash flows significantly exceed that of Apple's? Time will tell, I suppose. Okay, at this point, we should walk through a specific example as to how we actually put our discounted cash flow approach to valuation into action. So let's take a look at a company we all know well, Nike, the global athletic shoe and apparel company. For the 2014 fiscal year, Nike reported the following. Cash flow from operations of $3 billion. Capital expenditures of $880 million. Interest paid of $53 million, and finally, a tax rate of 24%. That's calculated by taking $850 million of income tax expense divided by $3.544 billion of income before tax. Again, cash flow from operations of $3 billion, CapExes of $880 million, interest paid of $53 million, and a tax rate of 24%. In order to compute the free cash flows, we first take the cash flows from operations and add back the after-tax cost of the interest Nike incurred during the year. It is very important that we remember that all valuation should be done using unlevered cash flows. Because Nike paid $53 million in interest before taxes, and because interest costs are tax deductible, we can estimate that Nike's after-tax interest costs was about $40.3 million, or $53 million times 1 minus 24%. Thus, Nike's 2014 free cash flows were $2.16 billion, calculated by taking the $3 billion of cash flow from operations, as reported, and adding $40.3 million of after-tax interest, and last but not least, deducting the capital expenditures of $880 million the company spent in 2014. Again, we take the cash flow from operations of $3 billion, add back the after-tax cost of interest expense, which is $40.3 million, and subtract off the capital expenditures of $880 million. To be clear, $2.16 billion represents the amount of cash Nike generated from operating and investing in their core business, assuming they had no debt at all. Knowing how to compute any company's free cash flows is a definite for our toolkits. Now we can move on to the fun stuff. Let's use this free cash flow information to determine what Nike stock should be selling for and whether it might be under, over, or fairly valued. Now, because Nike is an established global company, we can assume it will continue to grow, likely in line with the world economy. So let's assume that it will grow in perpetuity at a 4% annual rate. This would seem reasonable since the United States has averaged 3.25% annual growth in gross domestic product since World War II. Thus, we would assume that Nike's fiscal 2015 free cash flows would be $2.25 billion, 4% higher than 2014 free cash flows. Now, to value Nike overall, we need to take this estimated 2015 free cash flow and compute it as a growing perpetuity, just as we have before. Remember our growing perpetuity formula. We'll take the $2.25 billion of estimated free cash flows next year divided by the discount rate less the growth rate. Here, G, or the predicted annual growth rate, is 4%. But what about the company's weighted average cost of capital? If we assume it to be 6%, Nike would be worth $2.25 billion divided by 2%, which equals $112.5 billion overall. Now, it just so happens that Nike's enterprise value on the day I wrote this lecture was about $65 billion. As a result, it appears that the market is expecting Nike to grow more slowly than 4%, or to experience a higher cost of capital in the future.